I studied the exposed engine, which looked like it was made entirely of parts that would explode. I'd learned to pump my own gas. It was my big automotive triumph. What's wrong with the car? Nothing that I know of, except that it's old and tired. I'm changing the oil, putting a new spark plug, stuff like that. A tune-up? Of sorts. I'm taking off in a couple days. He reached in and removed a little knotty thing and wiped it clean with a rag before he put it back. He adjusted something down among the major organs. Where to? Vegas. I thought I'd ask Crystal if I could take Leela with me. What do you think? He wasn't actually consulting me, just making conversation while he went about his business. I can't believe she'd say yes. Never know with her. She's tired of Leela's problems. That doesn't mean she'd kick her out, I said. I waited for a beat, and when he said nothing, I went on. You think it'd be good for Leela, moving her again? At least over in Vegas she behaved herself. She hates that school she's in. Bunch of spoiled, rich debutantes. What a fucking waste. She seems to hate everything. He shook his head. She needs handling, that's all. Someone like me who won't let her get away with all the shit she pulls. Limits and boundaries. That's what I said. She gets that at Fitch, and so far it hasn't helped. Too much carrot, not enough stick. How does Leela feel about it? He looked at me sharply. Feeling doesn't have anything to do with it. She's headstrong and lazy. Leave it up to her, and all she'd do is lie around watching TV. Crystal's too busy trying to be your best friend. Doesn't work that way. Kid needs a parent, not a pal. I kept my mouth shut. Crystal wasn't going to let her go, but I wasn't there to argue with him. His tone of voice turned wry. You ever going to get around to telling me why you came? Sure, I could do that, I said. I understand Purcell came up here to talk to you about 4 months ago. I was wondering why. He'd heard a rumor Crystal was having an affair. He assumed it was me. Too bad I couldn't up and confess. I'd have taken a certain satisfaction shoving that in his face. It wasn't you. I'm afraid not. How long were you married to her? 6 years. Bad years? Good? I thought they were good, but like they say, the husband's the last to know. I've heard your relationship was volatile. He paused and leaned on the fender while he wiped his hands. We had chemistry. Stone and flint. We'd come together and the sparks would fly. What's wrong with that? She didn't have sparks with Purcell? Are you kidding? The way I heard it, he liked the kinky stuff. That must have been the shock of her life. Here she marries the guy thinking he's the answer to her prayers. Turns out he drinks like a fish and can't get it up unless she wears high-heeled boots and beats his ass with a whip. It doesn't surprise me she'd cheat. I might have slapped her around, but I never did that stuff. Was she faithful to you? Far as I know, I don't put up with any shit on that score. How'd you get along with Purcell? Considering he walked off with my wife, we did fine. You remember where you were? He smiled, shaking his head. The night he took a dive? I already went through that. The cops were here yesterday. What did you tell them? Same thing I'm telling you. I was working that Friday, the night of the 12th. I had a gig driving cabs. It's on the company books. Leela was here with her friend Paulie watching videos. Crystal picked her up Sunday morning as usual. You can ask her yourself if you don't believe me. I watched him for a moment. What happened to the earring? Took it out for an interview I had a few months back. Didn't want the guy to think I was a fruit. You get the job? No. Is that why you're going back to Vegas, to change your luck? Here's my theory. Things get bad? Think about the last place you were happy and go there. In a fit of guilt, I devoted all of Friday to other clients. Nothing exciting went down, but at least it paid the bills. The memorial service for Dr. Dowan Purcell took place at 2 o'clock Saturday afternoon in the Presbyterian Chapel on West Glen Road in Montebello. I donned my black all-purpose dress and black flats and presented myself at 1:45. The sanctuary was narrow, with high stone walls, a beam ceiling, and 50 pews divided into two sections of 25. Outside, the day was damp and gray, and the six stained glass windows, done in tints of deep scarlet and indigo, reduced most of the available light to a somber gloom. I don't know much about the Presbyterian faith, but the atmosphere alone was enough to put me off predestination. Despite the fact the mourners were assembled by invitation only, the crowd was sizable and filled the chapel to capacity. Crystal's friends sat on one side, Fiona's on the other. For some, the decision seemed easy. Dana and Joel, for instance, took their seats without hesitation, studiously avoiding Dow's second wife out of loyalty to his first. Those I judged to be mutual acquaintances seemed torn, consulting one another surreptitiously before they slid into a pew. While the stragglers were being seated, an unseen organist worked her or his way through a selection of dolorous tunes, the funereal equivalent of top 40 dirges. I used the time to contemplate the brevity of life, wondering if Richard Heavener intended to shorten mine. Mariah, when she'd called back, didn't seem that alarmed. Her theory was the Heavener boys would never risk another murder so soon after the first. This was not a comfort. Crystal had arranged things in haste, and it felt about like that. I guess organizing a funeral is like planning any other social event. Some people have a flair for it, some people don't. What made this one odd was the absence of a casket, a crematory urn, or even floral sprays. The announcement in the paper had suggested that, in lieu of flowers, a charitable donation should be made in Dr. Purcell's name. There wasn't even a photograph of him. In the matter of seating, I'd suffered a bit of conflict. Crystal had asked me to attend, but since I was technically in Fiona's employ, I felt fiscally obliged to sit on her side of the church. I'd settled on the aisle in the last pew, affording myself a panoramic view. Fiona's older daughter, Melanie, had flown in from San Francisco, and she walked her mother down the aisle as solemnly as a father giving away his daughter in marriage. Fiona was dressed, not surprisingly, in black, a two-piece wool suit with big rhinestone buttons on the jacket and the skirt cut mid-calf. Her curls had been subdued under a black velvet cloche, and she wore a veil suggestive of the Lone Ranger's mask. I saw her press a tissue to her mouth, but she might have been blotting her lipstick instead of holding back tears. Mel's hair, like her mother's, was dark, though the style was quite severe, hennaed and blunt-cut with dense, unforgiving bangs. She was taller and more substantial in an austere charcoal pantsuit and black ankle boots. Blanche followed them down the aisle in a voluminous maternity tent. She moved slowly, both hands framing her belly as though holding it in place. She walked as carefully as someone whose soup is threatening to slop out of the bowl. Her husband, Andrew, accompanied her, his pace slowed to hers. She'd left the children at home, which was a mercy on us all. Mrs. Stegler from Pacific Meadows sat just in front of me, brown suit, brown Oxfords, and her mop of red curls. There were also numerous doctor types in dark suits, and several elderly people I took to be Dr. Purcell's former geriatric patients. On the other side of the aisle, Crystal and Leela were ushered to their seats in the first pew on the left. Crystal wore a simple black sheath, her tumble of blonde hair giving her a look of elegant dishevelment. She looked tired, her face pinched, dark circles under her eyes. Leela had forsworn the outlandish in favor of the strange. A black latex tube top matched with a black sequin skirt. Her short, white blonde hair stood out from her head as though charged with static electricity. Jacob Trigg, in a coat and tie, swung into the church on his forearm crutches. He eased into a seat on Fiona's side, near the rear. Annika Blackburn appeared and smiled at me briefly before she took her seat in the pew across from mine. There was the usual rustle and murmuring, an occasional cough. I checked my program, wondering how Crystal managed to get it printed up so fast. Altogether, we were looking at a scattering of hymns, a doxology, two prayers, a soloist singing Ave Maria, followed by the eulogy, and two more hymns. A latecomer arrived, a woman with medium blonde hair whom I recognize belatedly as Pepper Gray, my favorite nurse. I watched her shrug out of her coat and tiptoe halfway down the aisle, where she paused while a fellow rose to let her into the pew. She walked as if she was still wearing crepe-sole shoes. The minister appeared in a robe like a judge, accompanied by his spiritual bailiff, who intoned the corollary of a courtroom, "All rise." We stood and sang, we sat and prayed. While all heads were bowed, I occupied my thoughts by reflecting on the state of my pantyhose and my unruly soul. I don't know why pantyhose can't be designed to stay in place. As for the state of my soul, my early religious training would have to be considered spotty at best, consisting as it did of sequential expulsions from a variety of church Sunday schools. My Aunt Jen had never married and had no offspring of her own. After I was so rudely thrust into her care by the death of my parents, she fell headlong into parenting without any experience, making up the rules as she went along. From the outset, she labored under the misguided notion that children should be told the truth. So I was regaled with lengthy and unvarnished replies to the simplest of questions, the one about the origin of babies being my earliest. My most unfortunate Sunday school experience came that first Christmas in her care when I was 5 1/2 years old. She must have felt some obligation to expose me to religious doctrine, so she dropped me off at the Baptist church down the block from our trailer park. The lesson that Sunday morning was about Mary and Joseph, of whom I instantly disapproved. As nearly as I could tell, poor baby Jesus had been born to a couple of deadbeats, with no more sense than to birth him in a shed. When my Sunday school teacher, Mrs. Nevely, began to explain to my little classmates how Mary came to be with child, I was apparently the only one present who knew how far off the mark she was. Up shot my hand. She called on me, pleased at my eagerness to make a contribution. I can still remember the change that came over her face as I launched into the doctrine of conception according to Aunt Jen. By the time Aunt Jen came to fetch me, I'd been set out on the curb, a note pinned to my dress, forbidden to say a word until she arrived to take me home. Fortunately, no blame attached. She made me a sandwich of white bread and butter, filled with halved Vienna sausages out of a can. I sat on the trailer porch step and ate my picnic lunch. While I played croquet by myself in her tiny side yard, Aunt Jen called all her friends, spoke in low tones, and laughed quite a lot. I knew I'd made her happy, but I wasn't quite sure how. When the minister finally stepped up to the pulpit, he made the sort of generic remarks that were safe for any but the most depraved decedent. The service finally ended and people began to file out of the church. I lingered near the door, hoping to catch Fiona before she left the premises. I wanted to set up a time to chat with her so we could sort out the details of our relationship. I finally caught sight of her, leaning heavily against Mel, who walked in tandem with her. Melanie must have known who I was because she shot me a warning glance as she guided her mother down the steps and out to the parking lot. Annika touched me on the arm. "Are you coming back to the house? Some people are stopping by." "Are you sure it's okay? I don't want to intrude." "It's fine. Crystal told me to ask. We're at the beach." "I'd like that." "Good. We'll see you there." The parking lot emptied slowly. The crowd dispersed as though from a movie theater, people pausing to chat while departing vehicles inched by. I returned to my car and joined the thinning stream. The overcast had lightened, and a pale hint of sun seemed to filter through the clouds. The beach house was only 2 miles from the church on surface roads. I must have been one of the last to arrive because the gravel berm on Paloma Lane was completely lined with expensive cars. I grabbed the first spot I saw, locked my car, and walked the rest of the way to the house. I sensed the crotch of my pantyhose had slipped to mid-thigh. I hoisted the suckers back into place by giving a little jump. For 10 cents, I'd peel them off and toss them in a bush. As I turned into Crystal's driveway, I saw the same vintage auto I'd seen at Pacific Meadows. Cautiously, I paused and scrutinized the area, noting that I was protected from view. The entire rear facade of Crystal's beach house was windowless, and the roadway behind me was momentarily empty. I circled the vehicle, checking the manufacturer's emblem affixed to the right front fender. A Kaiser Manhattan. Never heard of it. All four doors were locked, and a quick look into the front and back seats revealed nothing of interest. The front door had been left ajar, and the sounds spilling out were not unlike an ordinary cocktail party. Death, by its nature, reshapes the connection between family members and friends. Survivors tend to gather, using food and drink as a bomb to counteract the loss. There is usually laughter. I'm not quite sure why, but I suspect it's an integral part of the healing process, the mourner's talisman. There were probably 60 people present, most of whom I'd seen at the church. The French door stood open to the deck, and I could hear the constant shushing of the surf beyond. A gentleman in a cropped white jacket walked by with a tray, pausing to offer me a glass of champagne. I thanked him and took one. I found a place near the stairs and sipped champagne while I searched for the man with a mustache and thick silver hair. Jacob Trigg came up behind me, pausing as I had at the edge of the crowd. Many of the mourners were already engaged in animated conversations, and the thought of breaking into any given threesome was daunting. Trigg said, "You know these people?" "No. Do you?" "A few." "I understand you were the one who found Dow."
"I did. And I'm sorry he died. I was hoping he'd gone off to South America."
"Me too."
Trigg's smile was bleak. "Did Dow ever mention money missing from his savings account?"
"I know he was aware of it. The bank manager became concerned and sent him a copy of the statement with a query attached. Dow thanked him, said he knew what it was and he'd take care of it. In truth, it was the first he'd heard. Initially, he figured it had to be Crystal, since the statements were being routed to her P.O. box.
"Did he ask her?"
"Not about the money, but about the post office box. She told him she'd dumped it about a year ago. He didn't want to press the issue until he looked into it. It almost had to be someone in the house, because who else would have access to the bank card and the PIN number for that account?"
"Who'd he suspect?"
"Crystal or Leela, though it could have been Rand. He'd obviously narrowed it down, and he wouldn't say a word until he knew for sure. He and Crystal clashed over Leela so many times she'd threatened to walk out. If he'd had a problem with Leela, he'd have handled it himself. Of course, when it came to Rand, Crystal was just as fierce. Why take that on? There'd have been hell to pay there, too."
"How so?"
"He's the only one she trusted with Griff. Without Rand, where's her freedom? Dow was in a bind any which way it went."
"Why not close the account?"
"I'm sure he did."
"Did he ever figure out who it was?"
"If so, he never told me."
"Too bad. With his passport missing, the cops figured he might have left of his own accord. I wonder why Crystal didn't fill them in."
"Maybe she didn't know. He might have decided pursuing it wasn't worth the risk."
"He'd let someone walk off with $30,000? Dad?" Both of us turned. A woman with a thick blonde braid halfway down her back stood behind us. She was in her 40s, no makeup, in a long cotton sweater, a peasant skirt, and sandals. She looked like the sort who never shaved her legs, but I didn't want to check. She was too smart to wear pantyhose, so I gave her points for that. Mine were sinking again. Any moment they'd slip down as far as my knees, and I'd have to start hobbling, taking little mincing steps wherever I went. "This is my daughter, Susan." "Nice meeting you," I said. We shook hands, and the three of us stood chatting for a while before she took his arm. "I hope you don't mind if we go. This is all a bit rich for my blood," she said.
"She thinks I'm tired, which I am," Trigg confessed. "We'll talk again soon."
"I hope so."
Chapter 21. As soon as they left, I set my glass down and found the nearest bathroom. The door was shut. I tried the handle and found it locked.
I waited, leaning against the wall, making sure I was first in the one-person line. I heard the toilet flush, water running in the sink. Moments later, the door opened, and the man with the mustache and silver hair emerged. He smiled at me politely and went into the den. I shut myself in the bathroom and availed myself of the facilities. Having hoisted my pantyhose up the pole like a flag, I went out and found a perch on the stairs, 3 steps down from the top, the perfect vantage point from which to view the gathering. Rand was making the rounds with Griffith affixed to his hip. Griff was outfitted in a sky-blue sailor suit, and Rand mouthed Griff's imaginary monologue as though the child were a ventriloquist's sidekick. I hadn't seen Leela, but figured she was in the house somewhere. Crystal would never tolerate her boycotting the event. The caterers had finished setting out a cold buffet of boneless chicken breasts, 3 kinds of salad, marinated asparagus, deviled eggs, and baskets of fresh rolls. People loitered near the table in clusters, everyone trying to avoid going first. Ordinarily, I'd have left Crystal's long before now, but I was curious about the man with the silver hair. I saw him return to the great room, this time in the company of a gaunt brunette, who had a wine glass in one hand, the other hand hooked through his arm. She wore a black long-sleeved leotard under skin-tight black leather pants, cinched by a wide silver belt. The stiletto heels on her boots looked like 5-inch toothpicks. This was an outfit more appropriate to soliciting on street corners than attending a wake. Her body wasn't quite slick enough to bear up under such pitiless revelations. Her liposuctionist should have slurped another pint of fat from the top of each thigh. She seemed watchful, her gaze flitting uneasily around the room. Her smile, when it appeared, was self-conscious and never quite reached her eyes. I'm not sure I buy into talk like this, but her aura was dark. I could almost see the magnetic force field surrounding her. She was bristling, battle-ready. What was the deal here? The guy seemed to know quite a few people. Relaxed and at ease, he chatted first with one group, and then another while she clung to his arm. In contrast to her tart-like ensemble, his suit was well-cut, a conservative dark blue that he wore with a pale blue shirt and a tone-on-tone pale blue tie. I pegged him in his late 50s, one of those men who'd aged well, trim and fit-looking. He had to be a doctor. I couldn't think of what else he'd have been doing at Pacific Meadows at midnight, aside from the impromptu game with Pepper Gray. He murmured to the woman and then took his place in the supper line, picking up his plate and a napkin-wrapped bundle of silverware. Though she moved into line behind him, they didn't speak to each other. I watched him fill his plate to capacity while she helped herself to a demi-tasse of salad and 4 asparagus spears. He settled on the couch in the only remaining space. He rested his wine glass and his plate on the pale wood coffee table and began to eat. When she tried to join him, there was no seat left. She stood there for a moment, clearly hoping he'd scoot over and make room for her. He seemed intent on his meal, and she was forced to take a chair by herself at a distance. She busied herself with her plate to cover her discomfiture, though no one else present seemed to notice. The server walked by with a bottle of Chardonnay. She looked up at him sharply and held out her glass, which he filled generously. I sensed motion behind me and glanced up to find Annika coming down the stairs. She paused for a moment to peer over the rail. She was, as usual, dressed in understated good taste, a long-sleeved white silk shirt, wide-legged pleated black wool slacks, and black leather loafers as soft as slippers. Her auburn hair had been moussed, a pompadour in front with the sides combed back into sweeping ducktails. "Good place to sit. Have you had something to eat?" "I will in a minute when the line goes down. I've been doing some people watching. Who's that silver-haired fellow on the couch in the dark blue suit?" She followed my gaze. "That's Harvey Brodus. He and Joel must be dividing the honors. Joel and Dana went off to the country club where Fiona's holding court. Harvey came here. That way they can't be accused of playing favorites. Who's the woman in the leather pants?" "Celine, Harvey's wife of 20-ump years.
He walked out on her 8 months ago, and now he's come crawling back.
Oh, right. Crystal mentioned he was in the middle of a nasty divorce.
Was is correct. I guess the tab got too steep. He decided he was better off living with her than being stripped of his assets. He's a jerk, but I sometimes feel sorry for him. She drinks like a fish. Most of the year she's either checking into Betty Ford or checking herself out again. The rest of the time she goes off to some luxury spa, La Costa or the Golden Door. Nothing but the best for our girl.
Aren't married people ever happy?
Oh, sure. They're just not often happy with the person they're married to.
I saw her gaze shift.
Uh-oh. I better go down. Talk to you later.
Annika slipped by me and headed down the stairs. I glanced over at the front door where Pepper Gray had appeared. Annika spotted her and made her way over to the door. The two exchanged polite busses. Annika took her coat and then signaled the waiter, who veered in their direction with a tray of champagne glasses. Shorn of her white cap and white uniform, she seemed softer and prettier, less like a woman who'd performed extramarital first aid. I looked down at my silver-haired friend, wondering if he'd noticed her at the same time I had. Pepper moved into the great room. They had to be aware of each other, but neither paid the slightest attention. No nod of recognition, no greeting of any kind. Celine looked up and her body grew still, a forkful of food poised over her plate. Annika took Pepper by the arm, guiding her through the French doors and out onto the deck. Celine's head seemed to swivel, her gaze glassy and fixed. She watched Pepper with all the caution of a rabbit when a fox is in range. Either she knew for a fact that her husband was philandering, or her radar was superb. Probably a little bit of both. It didn't take much to guess how the dynamic played out. He screwed around on her as compensation for the fact that she drank too much, and she drank too much to console herself for his screwing around. As I watched, she got up and left the room. I waited on the stairs until the desserts had been arranged at one end of the table, and then joined the buffet line, which had shrunk considerably. I wasn't particularly hungry, but a seat near Harvey Brodus had opened up, and I wanted to take advantage. I filled my plate in haste, and then crossed to the couch. He looked up as I approached. Nice blue eyes. Anybody sitting here?
No. Go right ahead. I'm ready for dessert so you can save my place.
Sure, no problem. While he was gone, a woman in uniform came by picking up abandoned plates. I focused on the food, which turned out to be terrific. I ate with the usual animal enthusiasm, trying not to snuffle, belch, or spill down my front. Brodus returned with his dessert plate and a fresh glass of wine.
"Thought you might need this," he said, setting the wine glass on the coffee table next to me.
"Thanks. I was about to go in search of the fellow with the Chardonnay." Brodus held out his hand.
"Harry Brodus."
"Kinsey Milhone," I said, shaking hands with him. I surveyed his dessert plate. A brownie, a wedge of fresh fruit tart, and a chunk of coconut sheet cake. "That looks good."
"My sweet tooth."
He sat down again and balanced his plate on one knee. He chose the sheet cake first.
"I caught sight of you earlier, sitting on the stairs."
"I'm not one for crowds, and I don't know a soul." "What about you? Are you a friend of Crystal's or Dow's?"
"Both. I was in business with Dow."
"Pacific Meadows?"
"That's right. What sort of work do you do?"
He moved on to the brownie, making short work of it. "Mostly research," I said. I took a big bite of roll so I wouldn't have to elucidate.
"Sad day," he said. "I feel terrible about Dow, though I wasn't surprised. He was unbelievably anxious and depressed in the weeks before he disappeared."
"Oh, good. Gossiping at a wake about the dead. How fun." I said, "Oh, the poor guy. About what?"
"I don't want to go into it. Let's just say he left the clinic in a mess."
"Someone was telling me about that. Something to do with Medicare, wasn't it?" I took a bite of salad while he tackled the fruit tart.
"You heard about that?"
I nodded. "From a couple of different sources."
"I guess word must be out. That's too bad."
"What's the story?"
We think it was probably an honest mistake, but we may never know.
Doctors can sometimes be real dopes about business, I said, aping Penelope Delacourt.
Tell me about it. We were shocked.
I don't get what went on. I mean, as I understand it, the clinic doesn't actually do the billing. I thought there was an operating company to handle that.
He nodded. Genesis Financial Management Services. They have offices downtown. Joel and I, you know Joel?
Met him once. I know his wife.
Dane is great. I'm really crazy about her. Joel and I own the property through a company called Century Comprehensive, mostly real estate development, though we do other things as well. Genesis leases the physical plant from us. They also handle all the billing, accounts payable and receivable, Medicare, Medicaid, that sort of thing.
So how'd Dow screw up?
That's what we're trying to figure out.
Because I thought, you know, by law, your company and the operating company had to be completely separate.
True. But Genesis has to rely on the information they receive from Pacific Meadows. No one from the operating company's on site. If Dow reviewed and forwarded billing charges, Genesis took his word for it.
So he could have told him anything he wanted.
Could and did.
How'd he get caught?
We're not sure. It might have been a guardian or relative of a patient who noticed the discrepancies and phoned in a complaint.
What, to you guys?
To Medicare.
A whistleblower. Bad luck for him. So the fraudbusters jumped in and followed up?
That's our guess. At this point, we don't know what they have.
What if it turns out it wasn't him?
His reputation's still ruined. A town this size, once you've been tainted by rumor, it's almost impossible to recover your good name. People will be polite, but it's the kiss of death.
I guess from Dow's perspective, the whole thing looked hopeless no matter what.
More or less.
What if it turns out he's innocent, I said.
Either way, we're left holding the bag.
He glanced at his watch, set his plate aside, and got up.
Well, I better go find my wife. Nice talking to you, Kenzie. I hope our paths cross again in happier times.
I hope so, too, I said. I lifted my wine glass. Thanks for this.
Glad to be of service.
I watched him cross the room, scouting for Celine. What a bullshitter. Joel Glazer had been on the phone with Brodus the day I talked to him. I wasn't out of his office door before the information was passed on. What Brodus had told me about their business troubles was almost word for word the story I'd heard from Joel. When I got back to my apartment, the phone was ringing. Two rings. Three. I let myself in and snatched up the phone before the machine kicked in. Tommy Heavener. The moment I heard his voice, I realized I should have been screening my calls. He said,
"Hey, babe, it's me."
His tone was both intimate and assured, like I'd been waiting all day in hopes of hearing from him. The sound of his voice gave me a jolt sufficient to make me salivate like a dog. I had to remind myself that while I didn't want to see him, I might need his help in getting Richard calmed down. I ignored his seductive manner and said, "Hi, how are you?" All breezy and matter-of-fact.
"What'd you do to Richard? He's pissed as hell at you."
My stomach did a flip. "I know, and I'm sorry. I feel terrible about that."
"What happened?"
What happened? Well, think. The lie lurched from my lips. Lonnie wanted me to stay in the office, so he offered me a 50% discount on the rent.
"Why didn't you just say so? Richard would have understood that."
I never had a chance. He was in such a rage I couldn't deal with him.
"Why didn't you tell me? We could have worked something out. Christ, and then on top of that he found out you went and put a stop on the check. You should have seen him. He was screaming at the top of his lungs. You don't know what he's capable of once he gets like this."
I thought I knew Richard's capabilities. "Can't you talk to him for me?"
"That's what I've been trying to do. I thought if I heard your version of the story, I could reason with him. You blew this one bad."
"You're right. I know that, but it's like I explained to him. I thought writing him a note would be less awkward than telling him in person."
"Big mistake. That's what set him off."
I got that already. What do you think will happen next?
Hard to say with him. Maybe the whole thing will blow over. We can hope, he said. Anyway, enough about him. When can we get together? I've missed you.
His tone was playful, but it was all a front. I could either yield to him now, or he'd go right on working on me until I did. I could feel a slow, stubborn anger begin to rise in my gut. I tried to keep my tone mild, but I knew the message wasn't one he'd accept. Look, I don't think this relationship is going to work for me. It's time to let go. There was dead silence. I could hear breathing on his end. I let the silence extend. Finally, he said, "This is your pattern, isn't it? Distancing yourself. You can't let anyone get close." "Maybe so. Fair enough. I can see how you'd think that. I know you've been hurt, and I'm sorry about that. But give me a chance. Don't shut me out. I deserve better than that." "I agree. You do deserve better. Truly, I wish you well, and I'm sorry things didn't work out. Can't we even talk about this?" "I don't see the point." "You don't see the point? What the hell is this? I'm not going to argue. I'm sorry if I gave you the wrong impression. Who the hell are you, thinking you can talk to me like this? You the one came on to me. I'm hanging up now. Goodbye. Just a fucking minute. You stick it to my brother and I come to your defense, and you think you can turn around and pull this kind of shit with me? You're out of your mind. Great. Perfect. Let's let it go at that." I set the phone down in the cradle. Belatedly, my heart began to bang like someone dribbling a basketball. I stood there waiting. The phone rang, and even though I was expecting it, I jumped. 2, 3, 4. The machine picked up. I heard my outgoing message, and then he hung up. 30 seconds passed. The phone rang again. I lifted the handset and depressed the plunger, terminating the call. I turned off the ringer, and then, for good measure, I unplugged the phone. I sat at my desk and took a few deep breaths. I was not going to let the guy get to me. If I had to, I'd talk to Lonnie about getting a restraining order. In the meantime, I had to find a way to get him out of my head. I took my index cards and scribbled down numerous new notes, filling in a few blanks. Like a tarot reading, I laid out a spread of cards for review. Joel Glazer, Harvey Brodus, and Pacific Meadows formed an arc. Attached to those cards, there were two more: Penelope Delacorte, the associate administrator, and Tina Bart, the bookkeeper, who'd been fired. Joel Glazer and Harvey Brodus had gone to great lengths to suggest that Dow was at fault in the Medicare scandal brewing under the surface. The one item that didn't fit was the note I'd made about the liaison between Brodus and the frisky charge nurse who serviced him. I returned to the card for Tina Bart. Where had she gone? No doubt Penelope Delacorte knew, but she wasn't about to tell me. On impulse, I leaned over and opened my bottom drawer. I hauled out the phone book and turned to the B's. "When in doubt," says I, "why not start with the obvious?" 5 Barts were listed, none of them Tina or T. There was a C. Bart, no address, conceivably short for Christine or Christina. Single women do this abbreviation bit to avoid all the heavy breathers out there who dial numbers at random while pinching their pants. I plugged in the phone again and tried the number for C. Bart. After 2 rings, a machine cut in. The voice on the other end was one of those mechanical butlers, some computer-generated robot who talked like he was living in a tin can. "Please leave a message." Use of this proto-mail was another device used by single women who like to create the illusion of a guy on the scene. I reached for the Polk directory and looked for the telephone number listed for C. Bart. The Polk directory, also known as the Crisscross, lists addresses and phone numbers in 2 different ways. Unlike the usual phone book, which orders its information alphabetically by name, the Crisscross arranges listings by the street address in one section and by the telephone number in the second section. If you have only a phone number without a street address, you can look up the number in the Polk and find the corresponding street and house number, plus the name of the person living there.
Similarly, if you have only an address, you can track down the name of the occupant along with the phone number, providing the numbers published. In this case, I found C. Bart at an address on Dave Levine Street, not far from Pacific Meadows. Penelope Delacorte had told me that Tina Bart was already working at Pacific Meadows when she arrived on the scene. Not too much of a leap to assume she was working nearby. Time to find out how much she knew. Before I left the apartment, I searched out my old gun and tucked it in my shoulder bag. The gun is a Davis 32 semi-automatic with a 5 1/4-inch barrel, loaded with Winchester silver tips. During the past 3 years, I have taken a raft of shit about my use of this firearm, which I am told is cheap and unreliable, a judgment that hasn't altered my lingering affection for the piece. It's small and tidy, weighing a nifty 22 ounces, and it feels good in my hand. I didn't believe Richard or Tommy would actually come after me, but I couldn't be sure. And that, of course, was the nature of the game they played. Chapter 22. It was close to 5 o'clock as I traveled north on the 101. The afternoon light was already gone. Drizzle swirled through the moving traffic like a vapor, and the action of the windshield wipers formed a fan-shaped smear where the mist settled on the glass and was waved away. Dave Levine is a one-way street heading toward town, so I was forced to take the missile off-ramp and turn left onto Chapel. I swung up and around, catching the street at a higher point and following it down again. I passed Pacific Meadows on my right and began to scrutinize descending house numbers. The building I was looking for was only a block away. I found parking on the street and approached on foot, hunched against the misting rain. The structure was a plain stucco box, 4 units in all, 2 up and 2 down, with an open stairwell up the middle leading to the 2nd floor. Apartment 1 was on my right, with apartment 2 just across from it. The name Bart had been written in black marker pen and attached to the mailbox for apartment 3. I backed up 10 steps and checked the 2nd-story windows. Lights were on in several rooms on the front right-hand side. I climbed the stairs, knocked on the door, and waited. Behind me, through the open space between the halves of the building, I could see the rainfall, like gauze swaddling the streetlights. A draft of air was being funneled through the gap, and it was cold. "Who is it? Mrs. Bart?" I heard her secure the chain, and then she opened the door a crack. "Yes?" "Sorry to disturb you at home. I'm Kinsey Milhone. I'm a private investigator working for Dr. Purcell's ex-wife. Could I talk to you?"
I don't know anything. I haven't seen him in months."
"I'm assuming you heard his body was found up at Brunswick Lake."
"I read that." "What happened? The paper didn't really say."
"Would it make a difference to you?"
"Well, I don't believe he killed himself, if that's what they're trying to prove."
"I tend to agree, but we may never know. Meanwhile, I'm trying to reconstruct events that led up to his death. Can you remember when the two of you last spoke?" She made no response, but there was information in her eyes. A shift in the breeze blew a breath of fine rain against the side of my face. Impulsively, I said, "Could I come in? It's really getting chilly out here."
"How do I know you're who you say you are?"
I reached in my handbag and took out my wallet. I pulled my license from the windowed slot and pushed it through the crack to her. She studied it briefly and then handed it back. She closed the door long enough to undo the chain. She opened the door again. As soon as I stepped inside, she went through the whole process in reverse. I removed my slicker and hung it on a hat rack near the door. I paused to look around. The interior was a curious mix of old charm and annoyances. Arches and hardwood floors, narrow windows with yellowing wooden Venetian blinds, a clunky-looking wall heater near the bedroom door. The living room boasted a fireplace with a grate that supported a partially charred log resting on an avalanche of ash. The air in the apartment wasn't much warmer than the air outside, but at least there wasn't any breeze. Through an arch on the far wall, I caught a glimpse of the bathroom tile, a retro maroon and beige mix
probably installed when the place was built. Without even seeing it, I knew the kitchen was bereft of modern conveniences. No dishwasher, no compactor, no garbage disposal. The stove would be original, a vintage O'Keefe and Merritt with two glass-fronted ovens and a set of matching salt-and-pepper shakers in a box on top. Re-chromed and fully reconditioned, the stove would cost a fortune, though one oven would never work right and the hip young thing who bought it would unwittingly underbake her bread. Tina indicated that I could take a seat in a gray upholstered chair while she returned to her place on the couch. She was younger than I'd expected, in her 40s, and so lacking in animation, I thought she might be tranquilized. Her hair was the color of oak in old hardwood floors. She wore a sweatsuit, gray drawstring pants, and a matching jacket, with a white T-shirt visible where the front was unzipped. She had her shoes off. The shape of her foot was outlined in dust on the soles of her white cotton crew socks. She seemed undecided what to do with her hands. She finally crossed her arms and tucked her fingers out of sight as though protecting them from frostbite. "Why come to me?" "Last Monday, I went over to St. Terry's and talked with Penelope Delacourt. Your name came up, so I thought maybe you could fill in some blanks. May I call you Tina?" I asked, interrupting myself. She lifted one shoulder in a careless shrug, which I took as assent. "I know you and Ms. Delacourt left Pacific Meadows at about the same time. She said the choices here were pretty limited in the healthcare field. Have you found another job?" I hoped to give the impression of a long, friendly chat between Ms. Delacourt and me instead of the one we'd actually had. "I'm still looking. I'm collecting unemployment checks until my benefits run out." Her eyes were a pale gray, her manner flat. "How long did you work for them?"
15 years.
"Doing what?"
"Front office. I was hired as a file clerk and worked my way up. Nights I put myself through school and finally got my degree."
"In what?"
"Hospital administration and finance, which sounds more impressive than it is. I've always been more attracted to the accounting end of the business than to management, so I was happy where I was, more or less."
"Could I ask you some questions about Pacific Meadows?"
"Sure. I don't work there anymore, and I have nothing to hide."
"Who owned the building before Glazer and Brodus?"
"A company called Silver Age Enterprises. I never knew the owner's name. There might have been more than one. Before that, there was another company called the Endeavor Group."
I reached into my handbag and took out a little spiral-bound notebook with a pencil tucked in the coil. I made a note of the two names. With Silver Age, was the place owned and operated by the same people, or were those two functions kept separate?
They were separate. The Medicare and Medicaid programs were enacted in the 60s, and neither had much provision for fraud prevention. The regulations about arm's-length ownership and operations probably didn't come in until the late 70s, when Congress passed legislation establishing fraud control units, for all the good that did. You have no idea how many different agencies go after these guys. The Office of Inspector General, the Civil and Criminal Divisions of the U.S. Attorney's Office, the FBI, HHS, HCFA, and MFCU, the Medicare Fraud Control Units. Doesn't deter the fraudsters. Cheaters love rules and regulations. Every time you put up a barrier, they figure out a way around it. One of the many challenges of the entrepreneurial spirit, she added dryly. I saw Pacific Meadows change hands 3 times, and the price came close to doubling with each of those transactions. I made another note, thinking about ways to check out the dollar figures on those deals. Did you work for Endeavor or Silver Age? Actually, I think Silver Age was a subsidiary of Endeavor. The head of Endeavor was a woman named Peabody. She used to run all her personal expenses through our accounts payable. She'd renovate her house and write it off to Pacific Meadows as maintenance and repairs. Or she'd put in new draperies at home and claim she'd had them installed in all the patients' rooms. Groceries, utility bills, travel and entertainment. She never missed a trick.
Isn't that illegal?
Mostly. Some of it was probably legitimate, but a lot was fraudulent. I called a few items to the administrator's attention, but he told me, in effect, I'd better mind my own business. He said the company accountant routinely reviewed the books and everything was okay.
I knew if I pressed the point, I'd have been out the door right then. It seemed easier to shut my mouth. When Silver Age came in, someone else handled the books for a while. Then he got fired, and I took over again. There was probably some tinkering going on at that point, but I never figured out what it was.
Why didn't you quit and find another job?
I loved the work. You could have loved the same work somewhere else, couldn't you? True, but I got stubborn. I figured one day they'd crash and burn and I'd be there to watch. Maybe throw additional fuel on the fire.
Did anything change when Dr. Purcell arrived on the scene?
Not the first couple of months. Then I noticed an increase in the number of charge slips for things like ambulance service and physical therapy, portable X-ray equipment, wheelchairs. I started keeping notes, and then I wrote a memo to Mr. Harrington, the head of the billing department at Genesis. That was a mistake, as it turned out. But I didn't care. He never said as much, but I'm sure he didn't appreciate the effort, because it put him on the spot. You were a regular troublemaker.
I sincerely hope so.
So even before the audit, they were unhappy with you?
She nodded and said,
"Very. They let some time pass, and then they fired me. Dr. Purcell tried to intervene, but he had no power, and he was overruled. Penelope got upset, and she quit in a huff, which really worked in their favor. It made it look like we were guilty of wrongdoing, and Genesis was cleaning house. That still gave them Dr. Purcell as a firewall if the MFCU investigation proceeded,
which it did.
Oh, yes. They're not going to give up until they nail this one down.
As I remember it, Joel told me Genesis was part of a group called Millennium Healthcare.
It is. But my guess is that some, if not all, of those companies are shell corporations, set up to conceal the real ownership.
As in what?
Company A, owned by Mr. Smith, buys a residential nursing home. Smith sets up a phony company with a slate of officers who appear to be unconnected to him. His company, A, sells the facility to the second company, also his, at a greatly inflated price, effectively converting the profits into capital gains,
which are taxed at a lower rate, I said.
Right. The second company can use the trumped-up value of the newly purchased facility as collateral for new loans. Meanwhile, bogus Company C comes along and leases the building and grounds from the new owner with a substantial boost in rents.
I held a hand up. Hang on a minute. I ran the chronology back through my mind, trying to figure out what had caught my attention while she was laying it out to me. It wasn't anything she said. It was something I'd been wondering since I arrived at her door. The night he disappeared, Dr. Purcell left Pacific Meadows at 9 o'clock. Did he, by any chance, stop by to talk to you?
She paused so long I didn't think she'd answer me.
Yes. About what?
He told me he had a meeting scheduled with the FBI. He thought he knew what was going on and who was behind it. Namely, Harvey and Joel. But those two wouldn't have been in jeopardy, would they? I mean, from what I was told, they had nothing to do with the day-to-day running of Pacific Meadows. The real fiddle must have come from Genesis, since the Medicare checks were sent to them.
There may be more of a connection than you think. Dr. Purcell must have gotten greedy because he began to sign off on charges he knew were fraudulent. X-ray and ambulance services among them. He probably took kickbacks for those. The FBI put the squeeze on him, and that's why he agreed to help.
But what would be the point of silencing him? There must be plenty of other people who know about the scam. You, for one.
I never had any real authority. Now that he's gone, they can blame it all on him.
Did he tell anyone else what he knew?
He never said so, if he did.
But why come to you? I gather you didn't even know him that well.
He wanted my help. He figured I had nothing to lose.
Do you think he told Joel and Harvey what he was up to?
Not if he was smart. I know he had lunch with Joel that day, but he didn't say anything else about it to me.
I don't get it. With all these agencies at work, how come they haven't been caught?
She shrugged.
Most of what they submit is legitimate, and where the figures are false, everything else looks good. They use standard diagnoses and standard treatments. They're careful not to cross the line in any obvious way. It's like playing the float. They know how far they can push the system before the flags go up.
But the flags did go up. Any idea why?
Someone must have phoned in a complaint, because I talked to the fraud investigator last week, and most of what I told him he already had in his files.
The phony bills for Clotilda had to be part of the scheme.
I've got some information that should be of help, and I'd be happy to do a paper search early in the week if there's time.
That'd be great. I'll be talking to him again, and I can pass it on.
Something else I'm unclear on. Why take the chance on billing items out to someone deceased?
Listen, you're dealing with the local, state, and federal governments. You get caught, you say, oops, and give the money back. You think the government would prosecute for a couple $100 worth of errors?
Yeah, right.
What's the story on Harvey Brodus and Nurse What's-Her-Name, Pepper Gray?
He left his wife, Celine, for her, and then I heard he went back.
I studied her carefully, wondering if she'd answer the question that had just come to mind. Were you the one who phoned in the complaint to Medicare?
Someone else did that.
Who?
I'm not sure, but I suspect she did.
Pepper?
Yes.
Pepper was the one who dimed them out?
Well, think about it. When Harvey broke off their relationship, she was in the perfect position to blow the whistle on them. I noticed her name or initial showed up most frequently on charges for questionable goods or services. She probably dummied up the slips from the floor. Why should she go on protecting him once he dumped her?
Well, they're certainly tight now.
Really? That surprises me. Imagine the bind that puts her in if he finds out what she's done.
She let the thought trail, punctuated by a nearly imperceptible smile. On my way home, I stopped by the office to pick up some index cards. I had two fresh packs in my desk drawer, and I wanted to transfer the notes I'd managed to scribble in my spiral-bound notebook. I drove down Dave Levine as far as Capillo, where I made a left. Passing State Street, I could see that downtown Santa Teresa was deserted in the rain. It was after 6 p.m. on a Saturday, and most retail stores had closed. Their windows were lighted, but the interiors were dim, sporting just enough wattage to foil the roving bands of burglars. I turned into the driveway running under Lonnie's building and parked in the narrow lot beyond. I got out and locked my car door. Over the back wall, I could see lights coming from the cottage across the alleyway. I was unable to resist looking at the office space I'd leased one short week ago. The parking lot was empty. No sign of Tommy's pickup truck or his little red Porsche. The upper shutters along the right side of the one-story building were open, but the lowers had been closed. I saw a shadow intersect the light. Maybe Richard was showing the office to someone new. I turned away from the sight, knowing I was well out of it. What was done, and there was no point entertaining regrets. I counted myself lucky Mariah Talbot had showed up when she did. Otherwise, I'd be renting from a couple of stone-cold killers. I crossed Lonnie's lot and trotted up the stairs to the third floor. I let myself into the law offices, which were lighted but empty. I went down the silent inner corridor and unlocked my office door. I crossed to my desk, opened the bottom drawer, and picked up two packs of blank index cards still in their cellophane wrap. I opened one and began to make notes. For the next hour, I felt safe, absorbed in my work. At 7:15, I put a rubber band around my note cards and tucked them in my handbag along with the extra pack of blank cards. I locked the office and let myself out again, trotting down the outside stairs. At the first turn, I glanced out through the opening in the stairwell. It's not a window in any true sense of the word, just a slot, 1 foot wide and maybe 2 feet high, intended to help with ventilation. From the second floor, I had a clear view across the alleyway to the rear of the Heaveners' cottage. The back door now stood wide open. In the office to the right, which I still thought of as mine, the shutters stood open.
The light was on, but the window now had the blank look of unoccupied space. Something seemed off, but I wasn't quite sure what it was. Maybe someone had gone out for a moment, leaving the back door open for convenience. Whatever it was, I had no intention of going over there to snoop around. I continued down the stairs and crossed the small parking lot to my car. I drove home by way of the supermarket, stopping long enough to pick up toilet paper, wine, milk, bread, eggs, Kleenex, and a tall stack of frozen entrees. Once in my neighborhood, I was forced to park a block and a half away, which annoyed me no end. With my bag and two loads of groceries, I had to struggle to let myself in the gate. Halfway across the patio, I caught a flash of movement to my right, and someone stepped out of the dark. I jumped half a foot, barely managing to suppress a scream, as I dropped one grocery bag and clutched the other one. Tommy Heavener stood there, hands in his raincoat pockets. "Hey! God damn it! Don't do that! What are you doing here?" "Let's talk." "I don't want to talk. Now get out of my way." I hunkered to pick up my keys. One bag had ripped. I began to toss items back into the other bag. Half the carton of eggs were broken, and the bread was mashed flat where I'd grabbed it in haste. I had no idea how I'd get into the apartment, lugging the few items that were still intact. "Oh, forget it," I said. I found my keys and crossed to my door, aware that Tommy had moved to intercept my path. He stretched out an arm, hand flat on the door, his body crowding against mine. I turned my face to one side, trying to avoid contact. "Get away from me," I thought about my gun. "Not until you tell me what's going on. If you don't get off me, I'm going to scream." "You won't scream," he murmured. "Henry! Shh! Henry!" Henry's backlight went on. I saw his face appear in the door. "Help, bitch," Tommy said. Henry came out the back door with a baseball bat. Tommy glanced at him, turned, and walked away at a leisurely pace, showing his contempt, showing he wasn't intimidated. Henry came across the patio at a quick clip, bat raised, looking as angry as I've ever seen him. I could hear Tommy's heels clatter down the sidewalk, sound diminishing. "What was that about? Should I call the police?" "Don't bother. By the time they get here, he'll be gone." "Did he hurt you?" "No, but he scared the shit out of me." "I think you should file a police report. That way they'll have something on record in case he does this again." "I'll talk to Jonah on Monday." "Do more than talk. That guy's dangerous. You need to get a restraining order out against him." "For all the good it'll do. Really, I'm fine. Would you help me get this stuff in?" "Of course. Open the door and we'll get this picked up in no time." Sunday was full of hard rain and gloom. I spent the day in my sweats, stretched out on the couch under a quilt in my sock feet. I went through one paperback novel and picked up the next. I had another two for backup, so I was in good shape. At 5 o'clock, the phone rang. I listened to the message, waiting to hear who it was before I picked up. Fiona. I felt such relief, I almost warmed to her. She said, "Sorry, I didn't have a chance to speak to you after the service yesterday. Blanche had her baby late in the afternoon." "She did. Congratulations. What did she have?" "A little girl, 7 pounds, 8 ounces. They named her Chloe. Blanche was actually in labor at Dow's Memorial. She and Andrew skipped the reception at the country club and went straight to St. Terry's. There wasn't even time to get her into the delivery room. She gave birth on a gurney in the corridor." "Wow, that was close. How's she doing?" "She's fine. The baby had to stay an extra day because of jaundice, but the doctor seems to think she's fine now. We'll bring her home this afternoon. I told Blanche I'd keep the children tomorrow so she can get some rest. I wish she'd have her tubes tied and put an end to this. She can't keep churning out infants. It's ridiculous." "Well, I'm sure you're relieved everything's okay." "Actually, I'm calling about something else. Last night, when I went to the hospital to visit Blanche, I saw Crystal's white Volvo parked in the driveway of a house on Bay. You know that neighborhood. Parking's always at a premium. The hospital lot was full, so I had to circle the block to find a space, or I wouldn't have seen the car. Naturally, I was curious. So I went over again this morning, and there it was. I'm assuming there's a way you can find out whose house it is.
Sure, I can do that. Why don't you give me the address?
I made a note as she recited it and then said, "What's your concern?" I think she's finally showing her true colors. You know the rumor about Crystal's affair with that trainer of hers, Clint Augustine? I put it out of my mind until I spotted her car, and then I began to wonder. Whatever she's up to, I think it's worth pursuing, don't you?
Assuming it was her.
The license plate said Crystal, big as life. How do you know she was driving? It could have been anyone.
I doubt that.
Like who?
I don't know, Rand or Nika, one of the household help.
Melanie suggested that as well, though I don't know why either one of you would stoop to defending her. I called Detective Paglia and told him you'd be looking into it. As I said to him, this is exactly the sort of thing they should have been doing from day one. I was certain Detective Paglia appreciated her input. After we hung up, I dialed the gym and Keith answered the phone. I could hear weights clanging in the background. The Sunday faithful. Hi, Keith, Kinsey Milhone. When I was in there last week, I asked you about Clint Augustine. Do you happen to have an address and phone number for him? I've been thinking a personal trainer might be fun for a change. Let me see what I got. Hang on. I could hear him open the desk drawer and then flip through the tattered three-hole binder I'd seen on other occasions. I know I got it somewhere. Here we go. I jotted down the information, noting that the address he gave me was a match for the Glazer's house in Horton Ravine. How recent is this? Someone told me he had a place near St. Terry's on Bay.
Don't think so. At least it's the first I've heard.
When did you last talk to him? He might have moved.
It's been months. Might have been February, March, back around then. He used to come in here regular, maybe 8-10 times a week, although he might have moved his clients to another gym. Let me know if he's out of business and I'll take his name off the books. I got other good trainers if he can't help.
Great. I appreciate that. I pulled the crisscross from my bookcase and leafed through the pages until I found Bay Street. I ran a finger down the house numbers until I came to the relevant address. I'd hoped Fiona was wrong, but the listed occupant was J. Augustine, though the phone number was different from the one Keith had given me. I dialed the number Keith had and got a disconnect. No surprise there. That must have been Clint's phone number while he was in the guest cottage on the Glazer property. Clearly, Keith's information was out of date. I returned the crisscross to my shelf. I couldn't believe Crystal had gone looking for Clint the very day of Dow's memorial service. I picked up the phone and dialed the house on Bay. The man who answered had a phone manner that bordered on the rude.
Yes?
His voice was harsh and full of impatience. May I speak to Clint?
He can't come to the phone. Who's this?
Never mind. I'll try later. The house on Bay Street was an old Victorian, probably built in the late 1800s. Two stories of white frame with a wide porch that stretched across the front. This was a neighborhood where many of the single-family dwellings had been converted to medical offices servicing the hospital half a block away. There was no sign of Crystal's Volvo in the drive. A white picket fence surrounded the yard, which was small and bare of grass, thickly planted with rose bushes pruned now to clusters of thorny stems. I could imagine, in full bloom, the blossoms would smell as dense and sweet as potpourri. The soil was darkly saturated from the rain, which was falling now in a soft haze. I cruised past the house, did a turnaround at the corner, and came back. I parked across the street and settled in to wait. Visiting hours at St. Terry's wouldn't begin in earnest for an hour, so the streets were close to deserted. Even protected by a gauzy curtain of rain, I felt conspicuous sitting in the car by myself. This wasn't a surveillance.